Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we've got Jenna Anderson. Jenna is the Chief Executive Officer of Key Health. Jenna, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Likewise. So why don't we start with Key Health? What problem is it solving in the market?
Solving a major problem. We've developed the first portfolio of preventive-focused diagnostic tests. So today, when you think of diagnostic tests, you probably think it's a test that's going to tell me that I'm sick. But really, what these tests should be doing is telling you how to be well, how to optimize your health at a cellular level, and looking at diseases before they progress. So every test we come out with is looking at novel biomarkers that are identifying disease before you're symptomatic, and then helping you change trajectory so that you never get sick in the first place. I tell people, I'm like, how do you cure disease? You become the healthiest version of yourself. And that at Key Health is what we're focused on.
Holy cow. So, I mean, that's super impressive. All right. So for benefit of making sure that our audience has a clear picture, what was one of the first use cases?
So our first product was actually started at Yale University. We took IP and innovation from Yale University. We spent about 2 years expanding upon it, changing it, optimizing it. And we just clinically validated the first liquid biopsy test that can identify diabetes 2 years before you're symptomatic. Essentially, we're able to measure the rate at which your beta cells are dying. And to put it into context where we could all understand, we all have a pancreas. In the pancreas are beta cells. And the beta cells control how we uptake insulin. And insulin is energy. It's what helps us regulate things. It's what determines if we become diabetic, gives us energy, regulates hormones, does a lot of different things. And what we're able to measure is the rate at which your beta cells are dying. And why that's so important is today, at the time of somebody being diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, in most cases, half of their beta cells are already gone. So we're trying to catch it so much earlier. And we hope that essentially people don't ever get type 2 diabetes. We're able to mitigate that in the first place by giving them the earliest signals of disease development.
Oh, so when I hear this, I think about, okay, there's a profile of a clinical profile of what someone looks like before they get diagnosed with a disease. And if we know what those are, then it's possible to create a test that can then identify it ahead of time. Is that a good layman explanation?
Yes and no. So here's the way you look at it is many people would say, okay, well, why do I need to know if I'm at risk of developing diabetes? I'm healthy. I think I'm doing well. I have no family history of it, but it's deeper than that. You know, in fact, the current administration's nominee for Surgeon General, Dr. Casey Means, she's built her entire career around the fact that metabolic dysregulation is the undercurrent of all disease. It's what leads to chronic conditions. Think of it in the sense that we're the first test that can measure early metabolic dysregulation. We all should be metabolically regulated. And we're able to identify that at a cellular level before it's actually having negative consequences on your health. So everything we're looking at is early disease detection. In our pipeline, we have a test for pancreatic cancer that we're developing. Our goal of kind of the holy grail for the company is to have the first early detection test for neurodegenerative disease. We really want to seek out and find these areas where good, high quality early detection tests don't exist and flip the coin on its head and develop something novel.
And so if we were to classify conditions between chronic and acute, do most of these metabolic diseases fall in the chronic category or is it across the board?
They're all chronic. So when you think about it, I tell people, if you want to be healthy, there's only really three things you need to think about. Metabolic health. So are you metabolically regulated? Do you have low inflammation? And do you have a healthy gut? If you have a healthy gut, low inflammation, you're metabolically regulated, the likelihood is you're going to be healthy. But the challenge today is the healthcare system isn't set up to look at early indications of disease development. It's reactive by nature. Policies in the government, insurance providers, how doctors are trained, everything is, okay, you're sick, now what do we do? Versus, hey, what's going on today? How is your body performing? Are you developing disease and can we stop it in its tracks? That's where we come in and really are trying to change the game in diagnostics by identifying disease before it's having negative consequences.
And so deployment, is this going to be something that a patient can do at home, or is this something going to do when they come in for, say, a wellness exam?
That's such a good question. So the thing I've realized in my career and kind of what was a huge catalyst for this is accessibility and affordability are major challenges. You know, I walk into a room now and I ask people, I'm like, how are you doing health-wise? If I was to ask you even right now, do you have inflammation? Are you metabolically regulated? Do you have a healthy gut? Most of the time, almost 95% of the time, people are like, I have no idea. And it's not their fault. We're told to be healthy, but we don't even know how to be healthy because we don't know what's going on the inside. So our mission is really making these tests accessible. You should not have to fight or be confused or have it be complicated to access basic data about your body. So our tests are available online. They're available in retail pharmacy. They're available through your doctor's office. We're removing all barriers to access. So anybody anywhere should be able to know what's going on with themselves metabolically. The second thing is we want them to be affordable. So all of our tests are FSA, HSA eligible, and our goal is to have all of the tests under $300. So that anybody, ideally anywhere, can know what's going on in their body without having a major roadblock.
And how are the results of the exam or the test read? Is it right there on the spot, similar to, say, a pregnancy test, or do they have to be sent in?
They have to all be sent in. So our science is high science. It's complicated. You know, when I think about it, you have a myriad of tests. You have your pass-fail test. So like a pregnancy test, you are or you aren't. It's not really a scale. You're not partially pregnant. And the same with a lot of these at-home tests that are reading on the spot. We're doing a liquid biopsy. So essentially, we're taking your 1 mL of blood, which is not very much, and we're breaking it up into 20,000 different components. And then we're analyzing each one of those 20,000 components individually. So the process itself takes almost an entire day to analyze that one sample. So yes, you have to mail it in to us, but within 5 to 7 days, you'll get an email. You'll log into a HIPAA compliant portal where you can download or email your results. And it's pretty comprehensive because we're telling you what's going on with you metabolically. And then more importantly, what does that mean? If you've ever gotten blood work, it's probably confusing. And they have like a little question arrow. It tells you what the biomarker is, but you have no idea if it's good, bad, what it means, what you should do next. Our reports are usually about 10 to 15 pages. We're telling you what it means and we're telling you what to do next. And then we're giving you access to a physician, if you don't have one, to learn more.
Wow. I have a ton more questions, but before we do that, you know, I think it would be really helpful, excuse me, really helpful. What was the genesis behind Key Health?
Oh, that's such a good question too. So Key itself means the source within. You know, in my career, I tell people, usually if you end up where you're supposed to be, it wasn't by accident. It was a purpose or a passion that got you there. And, you know, I've had the privilege of working in and around healthcare my whole career, now over 18 years. But about 8 years ago, I made a pivot. So I was doing what I would consider more traditional healthcare. And, you know, about 12 years ago, my mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. She was diagnosed very young. She was diagnosed in her 50s. And I, you know, initially rolled up my sleeves, went after all the traditional approaches and hit a lot of walls, a lot of roadblocks. And I realized that the traditional healthcare system in many ways was not set up to deal with chronic conditions like Alzheimer's and neurodegenerative disease. And at the time, we also realized she likely had had the disease for 10 years and we just didn't know. We didn't know what to look for. There wasn't any early diagnostics. And so about 8 years ago, after doing a ton of research for 4 to 5 years and learning about this disease and being a caregiver, I changed the trajectory of my career. I said, I want to focus 100% of my time on preventative focused, you know, medicines, companies, activities. And really want to be at the forefront, or many would say the tip of the spear. I want to move that scale forward to really help people where the need is there. And 3 years ago, I had the opportunity with this business. There was some really novel IP, and we believed we could take that IP and potentially build a neurogenitive focused diagnostic, which is my personal mission. You know, we lost my mom, but other people shouldn't have to. You know, I make it my personal mission to give people the keys and understanding of how to prevent getting sick, then it makes everything else worth it. You know, I tell people I can confidently say I will never develop Alzheimer's. Can say it confidently because I now know how Alzheimer's is developed, where it comes from. And that's a lot of the focus of the work we do.
So, you know, it's interesting, you know, so first my condolences, you know, I know it's a, it can be a very challenging condition to have to deal with on a lot of levels. My father-in-law, similar boat, and, you know, I saw it firsthand. But you know, it's interesting as I listen to you, I mean, you've convinced me, like, I'm going to get this test done. But still, it's like, you know, I'd be curious to know your perspective of, is it just a knowledge gap that more Americans aren't aware that these technologies exist? Or is there something else cultural that's taking place, do you think, that is preventing more people from being proactive to understand whether or not they're at risk?
I think a knowledge gap is absolutely a factor, but I think the bigger factor is the system. The system isn't set up yet. And I think we're at a catalyst point. You know, we're seeing major change with the new administration's focus on prevention and RFK and potentially Dr. Means. But I'll give you a perfect example. I was at an event recently and there was a very well-educated physician on the panel, and it was a female-focused event on women's health. And somebody in the audience raised their hand and said, you know, I'm going into my perimenopausal years, I'm wanting to know more about my health and wanting to be more invested. But every time I walk in the door to see my primary care doctor, they won't run any tests. They won't give me any more insights. And I feel like I'm constantly shut down. I'd like to say that her experience is the minority, but her experience is the majority. And it's not the doctor's fault. These physicians are trained a certain way. They're not trained to focus on prevention. They're trained to follow the guidelines that our health system has put in place, which are very rigorous, and they're reactive. They're not proactive. They also have 8 minutes. So they're not going to talk to you about all these things you could be doing to get in front of your health. They're going to look at you and say, do you have high cholesterol? Are you about to die? And do you have any major complaints? So that's one of the biggest issues. The second major issue is payers don't pay for them. And, you know, we are of the mindset to think that healthcare is free. We believe that doctors are always right and healthcare should be paid for by the insurance company. So when people have that mindset and something isn't covered, they assume that they don't need it or they shouldn't want it. And if you ask most payers will tell you they don't ever cover prevention. It's not even in their mandate. So if doctors don't talk about it, payers don't pay for it, and consumers don't know to ask for it, or they aren't even empowered to know that that's something they should deserve, that's where you have a pandemic that we have right now of type 2 diabetes in this country, morbid obesity, even with the GLP-1s around, and chronic fatigue. If you ask around, you talk to people, hey, how do you feel? I mean, I always hear, oh, I'm so tired. I don't feel great. But the common thing is they don't know why, because nobody's looking and nobody's asking.
You know, it's interesting. You know, I totally understand how there is a limited amount of time and there's probably a lot of conversations can be have, but probably exacerbated by the fact that, I mean, I haven't been to medical school. But I can't say that for any of my checkups that I'm getting, you know, other than the questionnaire, what's my social lifestyle like? And so I could totally see where, yes, there's an opportunity for a shift to take place where, you know, somehow someone could figure out a way to start having conversations or at least introducing tests that can help identify
you know, like, hey, either from a genetic perspective or, you know, just a day-to-day decision perspective, maybe you should reconsider the path you're on and take steps to address it. Super curious. So for, you know, for audience benefit, a lot of universities out there that have intellectual property. What was your experience like engaging Yale, going through the process of saying, hey, you know, this is a piece of technological development that I think is really worthwhile and I want to bet on and bring it to life?
Wonderful. I will tell people, if you want to find innovation, you don't have to look that far. You just have to go to your local university. And that's honestly been the sad part for me as somebody who has seen the implications of unmanaged chronic diseases and lack of resources, to know there's all this innovation at the universities in our backyards across America that isn't ever going to see the light of day. You know, we're actively working with four universities right now. And if we thought it was bad, say 5 years ago, with innovations that could have major implications, and I'll give a small example of one. You know, there's a university, actually, I think it's in it's in Louisiana. It's right by Tennessee, which we were speaking about earlier. And they have developed a completely natural, you know, with elements coming from a multitude of different plants. And in a head-to-head study, it had 75% efficacy comparative to GLP-1s, which are obviously artificial. So there's products like that sitting on the market that just didn't get the funding or did not get acquired to move it from the university setting into the commercial market. And it's even worse now. So if you think it was bad then, imagine these universities had 75% of their grant funding cut. So all of this stuff that was sitting there in ideation, you know, there's another university we're talking to right now that has some incredible IP around cancer and early detection diseases and tests. And, you know, we're likely going to potentially acquire some of that. But, you know, it's wonderful. The universities are great to work with. You have to remember, these doctors and these scientists, they get into it for the right reasons. They want to help people. You know, they want to have a legacy, and their legacy is creating things with lasting impact. And they're not in it for the money, they're in it for the impact. And so working with them has been fantastic in my experience.
And so for the entrepreneurs who are listening, any key lessons or takeaway that you'd share with them, you know, if they're interested in engaging universities out there who have IP they want to bring to market?
Absolutely. So first of all, you want to understand where it is in the stages of development. So oftentimes you can have a great idea, and just because it works in a university lab does not mean it's commercially viable. And I think that's the thing. People will be like, oh, it's validated. It worked in a university lab. And I'm like, that's just because you can do one sample in a 3-day process does not mean you can run 10,000 samples in one day. So you have to understand that cascade. The other thing is you have to make sure you have the funding to take that idea from a piece of paper to something you can commercialize. And I think that's where a lot of times people miss the gap in how much money they're actually going to need. And it's going to be relatively significant. And that's another big one. And then making sure that you're negotiating a contract that you can live to. I think the entrepreneurial mistake is always, I'm going to be commercial in 3 years. And in reality, it's going to be 5. So making sure that you're giving yourself enough time to take that idea and get it to a place where it's actually generating revenue before you have to begin paying that university back.
And so then, did you find in engaging different universities that they'll also make a cut a check to assist bring it to life, or is the founder who's bringing the IP to market generally responsible for all the financing themselves?
So universities are an interesting ballgame. A lot of these universities will have a venture arm. And that's where you would have to go for the funding. The venture arms are usually most inclined, which makes sense, to fund from within. So they're going to be more inclined to fund a startup that came out of that university by someone who attended that university than an outsider coming in. So I would keep that in mind. Also, the checks they write are usually somewhat smaller. So 25,000, 75,000. If you're looking at healthcare, hate to say it, but a $75,000 check is not going to get you very far. Probably not even through a month. So when you're looking at those things, and you're going to invest the same amount of time to get money out of the venture arm of a university that you would be to go to a family office or a wealthy philanthropist, and get checks for $500,000 or $1 million. So you can get money out of that. That has not been a venue we've pursued.
Okay, good to know. Okay, so let's come back to Key Health. So what's the experience been and bringing the product to market?
I tell people that are always curious, what is it like to be a CEO? I joke, it's the loneliest job you'll ever have. And it is, but it's also crazy addictive, because this is my third time doing it, so I clearly haven't learned. But it's a struggle. Your first few years of building something is hard. And that's why I say, if you don't have a passion or purpose behind it, don't do it. Because halfway through, you're going to be like, this isn't worth it. You're not going to get paid as much. You're going to have a high failure rate. Everything is going to go wrong that you don't plan for, and you're going to have to pivot 10 times. So if you don't have kind of this desire to make it happen that comes far before whatever it is that you're building, it'll be very hard to make it through. But I think the draw for a lot of people is you are building. You get an idea and you get to go into a lab and say, okay, well, let's see if it works, or let's try this and let's move in this direction. And being empowered to know that you can come up with an idea and in 72 hours see if that idea worked. There are very few corporate settings where that is even possible. So it took us about 9 months longer than we anticipated to get through all of the clinical validation, because what we realized halfway through was we could validate the method that Yale did, and we could validate it in a commercial setting, but the method wasn't feasible. And what I mean by that is we could get decent, in lab terms, sensitivity, specificity, repeatability, so we know we're actually doing a good job of analyzing your blood sample, but we wouldn't have been able to do it at scale. The initial process took 17 hours, so that's two shift analysis. It was expensive. So what we had to do is go back to the drawing board. And essentially, if you think of it simplistically, if there are 10 steps to analyzing an assay, we changed 8 of them. So that we could take the same concept, we actually improved the sensitivity, improved the specificity, made it scalable and commercially viable, and we lowered the cost. And so it took us longer, but we came out of it with a much better product. And those are the things when you walk in the door of building your first lab, which was completely new to me, that I didn't even know we would have to do. So that's why I tell first-time founders, you got to have a good advisory board. You have to have far more capital than you realize. You think you have, I remember when we had our first like $1.5 million in the bank, and I'm like, oh, we have so much money. And a year later, we were almost broke. So it clearly shows you the money goes fast when you're trying to build something. And that is eye-opening. And the buck stops with you as a CEO. You have to make sure people are paid, the innovation moves forward, the shareholders are happy, the board is pleased. So there's a lot of responsibility in that role.
Agree 100%. And I think for maybe if the members of our audience, they've heard us talk about how because healthcare is conservative, it can be really difficult to sell because you have key considerations like efficacy, stakeholder buy-in. And so what, notwithstanding fine-tuning the product, what's your experience been like? Engaging stakeholders within the healthcare continuum.
You are spot on. Healthcare is not for the faint of heart. It's definitely not AI. I think what's challenging is we have really four stakeholders when you think about it. We have the doctors, and this is a new novel biomarker. In fact, I've been in a room of a few hundred doctors, and I say beta cell, and I can pretty much guarantee you half of them are like, what's a beta cell again? I mean, I know I learned about it at some point, but it's not something they talk about. They treat, they discuss, unless they're in endocrinology in some cases. So there's an education gap around what our biomarker even does and how impactful it is. The second stakeholder is going to be the payers. UnitedHealthcare, Anthem, we've had the pleasure of meeting with all of them. and they all see the value, but the system is challenging for them to figure out, okay, we know there's value here, but our system isn't set up to cover that value. So how do we, change the system to some degree to open the floodgates to enable that? And that's an ongoing process. I mean, we're still in the process of getting a PLA code, as an example. The third stakeholder is going to be the consumer. And they're right now the most important stakeholder. Because even if they hear about it or they get it from their doctor, they will more than likely, for the foreseeable future, for the next 3 to 5 years, they'll have to advocate. They're going to have to go out there and say, I want better. I want to know what this is. I want to understand what's going on in my body. They are the easiest consumer when it comes to adoption. And the concierge medicine doctors, because they're more on the forefront, they have a paying customer. But then the fourth, and maybe even the most impactful customer we have, are actually manufacturers. That are developing drugs, that are developing GLP-1s, that are developing drugs for the treatment of type 1 or type 2 diabetes, where we're a key biomarker to showcase effectiveness of their therapeutic. And they're trying to get better biomarkers to understand how their therapeutics are going to work in these target populations earlier in disease development. So everybody's looking further up the funnel. There's been a lot of competition in the, okay, you're already really sick. But how do we intervene and treat the people that are not really sick, but they're becoming sick? So, as a startup company, we have four different stakeholders that we have to appeal to and strategize for, to ensure the success of our business.
I'm curious. I can make a case either way, but do you find yourself, from an insurance perspective, more gravitating towards commercial or Medicare and Medicaid?
So, both. But in different ways. So we are going as a lab-derived test, which is essentially what we are. Everybody says LDT. We are governed by CLIA and COLA. They are our version of the FDA. So we are a CLIA-certified COLA lab. We can, run our tests. We've gone through all that process. But in order to get coverage by Medicare, Medicaid, frankly, any of the private insurance providers, you have to be FDA approved to get broad coverage. So even though we don't need it to sell it to you, we are taking the path of getting our first indication approved by the FDA before the end of the year. That indication we will submit to Medicaid and Medicare for coverage on. It's our smallest indication, so we feel we have the biggest chance to get in there at a more rapid fashion, and then use that indication as a predicate for follow-on approvals. So yes to both, but with different strategies.
Got it. And then what's the expectation of dealing with CMS? Is it anticipated to be easy? I don't know, easy is probably not the right word. Less painful or sorry.
CMS is painful for everyone, and it's constantly changing. So, what most people don't realize is private payers follow CMS. So, you pretty much have to go to CMS first. They have to say, yes, you're legitimate. Yes, we want to work with you. Yes, we want to cover you. And the private payers go, okay, well, they did all the heavy lifting. Now we'll say yes, but we'll give you a haircut. So, CMS is first. And you're making the case. The good thing is, in our first indication that we're going for is type 1. What most people don't realize is there is currently no direct biomarker for measurement of the development of type 1. There's indirect markers. So there's the autoantibody test, which is showing you propensity for disease development. There's C-peptide and HbA1c, which would come a little bit later in the progression of disease. We could essentially be the only direct measure for stage 1 and stage 2. That gives us a way in where we're going in and saying nothing exists today and we can fill that gap. So we're hopeful that that will enable us to get there faster. But if you look at, as an example, I use this one because it's an easy one, like Cologuard. Everybody knows Exact Sciences. They're making a lot of headway. They're a multi-billion-dollar company. They were in the market for, I believe, almost 15 years before they got FDA approval. And it was probably close to 20 years from foundation before they had any type of coverage. So it takes a long time. That said, that process is changing and becoming more rapid. So we anticipate that we'll get coverage faster.
Fantastic. Makes me happy to hear. So, when I obviously diagnostic tests have been around for a while, but the technology that you're bringing arguably is new. So how are you thinking about grabbing market share? Do you really think, hey, I'm taking it, or am I making it?
Such a good question. Both. So We don't see, like, as an example, people be like, "Oh, are you a competitor to the HbA1c test?" And I'm like, "Absolutely not." If you have an elevated HbA1c, you're past needing our test because you're already sick. You could use it in conjunction. It might give you some more insights, but we're again trying to carve out a space earlier on the funnel. So in many cases, we are creating a category. Some people would call it longevity diagnostics, some will call it preventive diagnostics, but the common core concept behind it is I want to know what's going on in my body and I want to know earlier. I want to be in the driver's seat. And I think COVID was an eye-opener for a lot of people. They thought they were healthy or they thought their friends were healthy, and then they saw them get sick or potentially die. And they go, "Well, maybe I'm not as healthy as I thought I was." And this new population, of which 50% of the US population does not have a primary care provider, so they're not even going to the doctor. They're not getting regular checkups. They want to know what's going on with their health. They want to know it from home. So we are definitely creating space in a category and going after this consumer and saying, you can know what's going on in your body from the comfort of home, without having to have a doctor prescribe it. So that's creating category. And then when you think about adopting or competing for space, it's being included as part of that panel that your doctor would prescribe annually.
And, it's interesting as I'm reflecting on what you're sharing. I mean, there's pros and cons coming out of the pandemic. And, if you, I, you know, I'll speak for myself. When it was all said and done, I admit I'm a little bit more skeptical than I was in the past. But obviously, my health is still really important to me. And so, you're right. I mean, if I have the ability to get an advance warning, it's important to me, but now I'm also conscious who are the stakeholders I'm engaging to get that answer. And so,
And you are, I would say you are more in the majority than the minority. I think for a lot of people, they feel like they didn't get the full truth. Like maybe the ivory tower that the government and some physicians might have been put in prior to COVID has changed. And they want to fact check. They want to know the science behind it. They want to better understand their body. I also think a lot of people heard for a long time that your genetics are your genetics. I mean, you've probably heard this, you've been there. I have a bad hip because my dad had a bad hip, or I'm going to get heart disease because my dad had a heart disease. But what science has told us is that's not true. Genetics, I don't want to say they don't matter, but they're not the decision maker. What really matters is epigenetics. It's what you're expressing. It's what's going on in your environment that's activating those genes in a positive or negative way. So now you're in the driver's seat. You can decide what's going to happen with your health. You're not a passenger. And now that you know you're a driver, you're like, "Oh, well, maybe I should look under the hood and see what's going on."
accountability is great. And now we have, some, it sounds like some pretty amazing exams to help, give us the ability to do something about it. Jenna, really appreciate your time. Before we wrap up, one of my favorite questions that I've been asking our guests is retrospective. And so if you had an opportunity, go back, have a conversation with your younger self, what would you share?
Everything you're going to do for the next 15 years in your career are going to get you exactly where you need to be. I think sometimes you don't know at the time that the pivot you take here or the job you took over here that didn't seem to make sense at the time gave you a skill set or an element of knowledge that was crucial for you to do the job today. And that has been 100% true for what I've done. I look back at every job I've ever had and I'm like, gosh, if I didn't have that job, I wouldn't know how to do this. So don't be so hard on yourself for the pivots. The pivots have an impact and they're necessary, and just see where that knowledge takes you in the next step.
Love it, and agreed 100%. I think we can probably devote a podcast to divine intervention, but everything happens for a reason. And yes, I mean, I think especially maybe among CEOs, we're really hard on ourselves. And I think it probably just comes with the territory. But I think it's a great insight that all will be well. Last question. I guess two more questions, but mentors or anyone in your network who you would like to see be a guest on the Innovators and Investors podcast. Anyone come to mind?
Yeah, I have a great mentor. I actually mentioned him the other day. Kurt Busch. He's the CEO of Sentient. He's amazing.
Okay.
He's a mover and shaker, incredible talent, has built that company from the ground up, and it's an incredible company. But more importantly, he's just a great human. He's very giving of his time and his knowledge, so he'd be a great guest.
It's I am going to share that with the team, and we're going to make an effort to see if we can't get Kurt on the podcast.
Wonderful.
Jenna, if there are any members of our audience who would like to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
I would love to talk to any of them. They can reach out to me at jenna@keyhealth.com. That's keihealth.com. And I'd be happy to connect with any of them.
Awesome. Great stuff. Jenna, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. It's been an awesome podcast. I learned a ton. And again, benefit of our audience, Jenna Anderson, CEO of Key Health.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. And again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder, CEO of FinTrack Management. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Innovators Investors Podcast. Take care.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor who would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.